Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Armenian News Network, Krung's Week in Review podcast. I'm Hovik Manucharyan, and together with Aspet Bedrosyan, we will be hosting this week's podcast with our guests, Aspet Kochikyan, Emil Sanamyan, and Alan Zamanyan. Keeping up with news related to Armenia and Armenians can be challenging. The sheer volume of the news in the past few years has increased greatly, and along with that volume, we've seen the rise of the fake news phenomenon, contributing to the erosion of trust in the news media. The diversity of languages used by the worldwide Armenian community also poses a challenge for Armenian news. There is a significant portion of news that originates in Armenian, sometimes in Russian, and does not get adequately translated into English, or Western Armenian, for those in the diaspora who are not proficient in Eastern Armenian. Finally, with the COVID-19 pandemic and the political turbulence in countries where significant communities of the Armenian diaspora reside, be it Syria, Lebanon, the United States, etc., many of our friends and colleagues indicate that they're simply overloaded with information and lack the time and energy to separate the good from the bad. So, we're creating this weekly digest of news and analysis that we find relevant to share with our friends and the wider Krung audience. Our goal is to provide a brief overview of the main headlines of the past week, and then cover a smaller set of more important developments curated by Krung editors and contributors who spend an inordinate amount of time daily to process Armenian news. We hope that over time this podcast will help our listeners in becoming more astute consumers of Armenian news. We will strive to provide a rich set of notes with each installation, with links to the most relevant articles and information as a starting point for your further investigation. Today's episode was our first attempt, and we'd love your feedback on all aspects of the show: content, format, technology, and how we can improve each time. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing from you. One of the major issues this week was the continued saga over the Constitutional Court. So, you know, let's talk about that limbo, and I'm going to do a quick intro, and then we can have a discussion. So the saga around the Armenian Constitutional Court continues this week. The three judges who were targets of persistent efforts by Pashinyan and his MyStep, or Imkhail, parliamentary faction, have taken their case to the European Court of Human Rights, and the ECHR immediately, sort of within a few days, refused to grant an injunction, which was intended to prevent any change in the makeup of the Constitutional Court until the case is fully deliberated. However, there are indications that the ECHR intends to expedite this case, since several news reports reported that, you know, they have given a deadline of August to submit their position. And also, let's remember that last week's amendments to the Constitutional Court have not taken effect, since President Sarkisian has not signed it, and he has said that he won't sign it. And he also announced that he will not refer the bill to the Constitutional Court, which most likely will mean that the bill will be signed by the President of the National Assembly, Arad Mirzoyan, after the 21-day constitutionally mandated period expires. So that's, I think we are in the first week of that, so we have two more weeks to go, or approximately. But this has left the court in limbo, where the critics say that the three justices who are still considered as serving their term, while the government maintains that the justices are out, even if the law hasn't been signed. And in fact, some of the justices tried to enter the court, and they were prevented from doing so by the police. So, with the three judges being out, and two judges who took vacation, for the first time since its founding, the Constitutional Court doesn't have a quorum, and this is the second week that is the case. So, going a little bit more into detail on this issue, I think, is important for our listeners. So, I'm going to quickly do a recap. The 2015 Constitution, which was coincidentally authored by Hrant Hovmatyan when he was Minister of Justice, reduced the term of the Constitutional Court judge to 12 years. Previously, it was until retirement. So that can be seen as a positive, in my opinion. But in order to bridge the gap between the old term limits and the new ones, the new constitution included a transitional clause, which effectively means that the new term limits only apply to newly appointed justices. So the old justices were meant to serve their terms for life, while new justices would have a 12-year term. And this would mean that Hrant Hovmatyan would get to serve until his retirement in 2035, and he would maintain the position of chairperson of the Constitutional Court. And
recapping again sort of the steps. First, you know, they opened a criminal case against Tolmasyan in late 2019. However, the Constitutional Court refused to lift his immunity. Subsequent to that, they passed a law giving the CC members the option to retire early with full pay, and which critics say amounted to a legal bribe. None of the judges took that option. The third one was, once the retirement enticement failed to bear fruit, the in-piled parliamentarians decided to solve the issue via constitutional referendum. And we all know that it got canceled due to COVID. In June, the National Assembly tried to solve the pattern again via controversial changes to the Constitution. And this is where we're sort of at. But they failed to heed the advice of the Venice Commission to seek approval from the Constitutional Court before voting on it during the second reading. And this, additionally, the president also signed away his right to sign constitutional changes. And I believe this is one of the, this may be one of the contentions from the opposition. I don't know if they will complain about this specific aspect in their appeal to the Constitutional Court. Lastly, the National Assembly changed another law, the law on the Constitutional Court, which appeared to be in conflict with the Constitution itself now, and because it specified different periods when the terms should take effect. All right, so so what happened this week? The three judges that are being removed appealed to the ECHR, citing three measures. One of the measures was a request for an urgent ruling based on Rule 39 of the ECHR declaration, and they wanted to prevent the makeup of the Constitutional Court from changing before the full case is heard. And meanwhile, another Constitutional Court session failed to be heard because of the lack of quorum. There are three judges who are in legal limbo, and two other judges are on vacation. Essentially, we are in gridlock. The only other, I guess, important thing to mention is that the opposition, mainly the Prosperous Armenia Party, submitted an appeal to the Constitutional Court on behalf of 26 members, challenging the constitutionality of everything that has happened recently, or most of, you know, some things. That appeal is actually on the docket to be heard by the Constitutional Court. The other thing to be heard by the Constitutional Court is actually the case involving presidential immunity for Robert Kocharyan, which is interesting because those two cases cannot be heard by the Constitutional Court because of the lack of quorum. I wanted to ask if anyone would volunteer, what does the ECHR refusal for the urgent measure mean? You know, what are we going to see happen over the next few months or years as this case goes moves to the court?
Well, obviously, it means that they didn't find an argument put to them compelling enough. The one precedent that came to my mind was 3 years ago in Georgia when the Georgian government was taking over a main TV station, at that point main opposition TV station, Rustavi 2, and the European court had issued an injunction that stopped the government from taking over the TV station, and it was seen as a big victory for sort of freedom of expression in Georgia, but eventually court actually came around and okayed the government's takeover of the court, of the TV station. So we'll see what eventually happens, but we can tell from other cases that, you know, have sort of had come to Armenians' attention at ECHR. You know, this things take forever to adjudicate at ECHR. The case of that Armenian shepherd who was killed in Azerbaijan took almost 10 years, and that's, you know, murder. The case of the families of Armenian officer who was killed in Hungary also took a long time to adjudicate. So I think that's going to drag on at ECHR. Most likely, judges will come away with some kind of compensation ordered by ACHR. But in the meantime, it seems pretty clear that the government will continue to push towards replacing the judges and restructuring the court. One idea that's being floated right now as part of the more broad constitutional reform package is to eliminate the constitutional court. And to some extent, that might be the most prudent approach as far as this situation, because any other approach by the government will most likely result in some kind of reversal down the road with ACHR, in eventually weighing in on the violations in the legal proceedings that have taken place so far.
Yeah, essentially, it seems like the ECHR is saying we'll consider whether we're going to pay back pay to the judges, but none of the changes that Armenia did are are require the urgency of the injunction.
Aspect Kochikyan here. I think there is there are two aspects here to the context here. One is also, as Hovik mentioned, the case that former President Kocharyan had sent to the Constitutional Court, which actually they withdrew and they sent it to the Court of Cassation. So at some point when that was still in place, there was more incentive, I think, for the judges to stay and fight the fight, because there was an issue of dealing with political vendetta, some would call it, others would call it about accountability and so on and so forth. The other thing is, I think the European Venice Commission the Venice Commission was also involved with this, and the Venice Commission's judgment or verdict is that, you know, these things can proceed. You know, the problem is the law is such a complicated, laws are such complicated languages, legalese, that both sides, quote unquote, the government and the opposition, when the Venice Commission first announced that, you know, the constitutional change regarding the constitutional court, was legal, each side actually looked at it as a victory and so on. So there's a lot of murky water going on. The other thing is I think it's a stalling tactic. Does the court or does the constitutional court have to meet in order for this to be in effect, or they can be just those people whose tenure is over, they can just be dropped, quote unquote? And if it's the former, if they have to meet, I think vacation time is just a tactic, a stallment tactic to not have a quorum. And that can drag on. It's not only about the European court. It's not just about the ECHR, but also it's about domestic internal sort of stalling tactics to be used to get this drag on for a while.
Yeah, if I can just add, the Kocharyan case was obviously the whole purpose of this whole mess of the Constitutional Court. And now that the Constitutional Court is basically immobilized and unable to issue any rulings, I think the government, Nikol Pashinyan specifically, should be satisfied with the situation, because the whole point of this situation from the beginning was to eliminate the possibility that the Constitutional Court basically upholds either Kocharyan's immunity for prosecution or sort of the issue with the 2009 criminal code being applied to 2008, one of those issues, and sort of builds a wall, legal wall, in front of that prosecution. So as long as Constitutional Court's participation is eliminated, I think he should be satisfied.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little bit of context from what I heard in the news this week. Apparently, the Armenian representative met with the ECHR president a day before the decision was published. And interestingly, the decision didn't mention this fact. The reason I mentioned that is because there was a section at the bottom of the decision that said that basically anyone that had been on the court before 2014, when Alvina Gyulumyan, one of the current constitutional court judges, was a judge in the ECHR, was not allowed to participate in this, you know, in forming this decision, because there could be potentially a bias. So the decision made a point of mentioning this this step that they took to avoid bias, but also didn't mention that there was a meeting between the Armenian representative and the CHR president. This is, I think, important because essentially the ECHR at this point decided to kind of get out of the way and let the proceedings go on as the Armenian government wants, and, you know, kick the can down the road, essentially, to address this at a later point in time.
Yeah, good point. So the 26 signatures from Prosperous Armenia. What is your take on that? And I guess it all depends on who is going to be judging that. But I wanted to see, you know, why, you know, especially like I'm really interested why Bright Armenia or Edmund Marukyan's party decided not to join, you know, this appeal. What is the calculation that they're going by? Sure. Yeah, Emil, go ahead.
Okay. As far as this vote, I mean, there is a lot of what people sometimes call kabuki theater happening here, sort of, you know, dressed in a legalese and sort of the parliamentary. But in reality, it's politics. It's very clear that you have Nikol Pashinyan, who's continuing to assert his sort of converting his popular authority into administrative and sort of pure power authority, and you have you know, people associated with the former governments trying to resist it in certain ways, especially when it comes to affect them directly. You know, obviously, had Kocharyan not been charged and Kocharyan not been sent to pretrial detention, I highly doubt he'd be politically involved in any of this. And similar story with Serge Sargsyan. I mean, up until he got involved sort of trying to help Kocharyan via the Constitutional Court, you know, he was sort of left alone, and people associated with him, his son-in-law, weren't all that upset with Nikol Pashinyan. They're trying to accommodate with him. So you have this kind of two poles created, the former governments and Nikol Pashinyan. And when it comes to everybody else, you know, they're kind of, you know, weighing bargaining positions. And Gagik Tsarukyan, obviously, in the beginning, was clearly trying to find accommodation with Nikol Pashinyan and trying to be friends with Nikol Pashinyan, even though, you know, I don't know how likely that could have ever been. But as soon as, you know, it became clear that it's not possible and the government will try to squeeze him for money, he is, you know, all of a sudden appealing to the Constitutional Court and objecting to some kind of constitutional change. When it comes to Marukyan, I think there is a calculation there that he wants to find sort of be that third force that is not seen as allied either with Robert Kocharyan or Nikol Pashinyan. And he will, you know, I'm sure continue to take those steps. Because from the perspective of even legal action, any kind of appeal by the parliamentarians against the change of the constitution and change of the constitutional law would have been futile, considering that you know, the court was already considerably immobilized. We didn't have really a constitutional court in a position to sort of challenge the government from the beginning. If we go back again to the time when they took this case under consideration, if their position was to challenge the government, they would have probably ruled on it within weeks or, I mean, even days, just like Parliament took a couple of days to change the constitution. But they didn't do that. They deferred it to the European opinion, this and that. They took over a year of the time that Kocharyan was in prison to look at this case. I mean, obviously tells you that, you know, there is a considerable reluctance on the part of the Constitutional Court to do its job. There's considerable reluctance on the part of the opposition to do its job. So we have a situation that's purely political. And like I said, it comes down to who are you with? Are you with Kocharyan or you're with Pashinyan? Erdogan Marukyan wants to create the sort of third alternative. I don't know how successful he's going to be because there is really no precedent in Armenia where you've had a very successful third alternative. If we look back at how political system in Armenia changed after 1998 all of those permutations since then, has not been a successful party. I mean, some people compare Marukyan to Artur Bagdasaryan that sort of played both sides as well. But we'll see where it goes. But that's generally the picture. It's about political fight and all of this just dressed in a legalese.
Okay. Well, let's see what the coming week will bring. Maybe we'll touch this topic again before it dies out. Next, I want to talk a little bit about polls. There have been a few polls that came out this week. So, you know, in the West, polls are a ubiquitous part of a citizen's life. There are polls for everything all the time. Vendors make decisions about products based on how buyers rate them. Similarly, people's views about their leaders are influenced through polls rating their performance. Many politicians are highly attuned to what polls say. They use polls in their decision making. The three major polls that were a topic of discussion in Armenian politics over the recent weeks. And in this segment, let's try to sort of make sense of it for our listeners. So all three polls appear to show a significant amount of popular support for the executive government, despite the recent rocky news related to COVID and consolidation of domestic opposition forces. But how are these polls conducted? Who conducts them? How does data turn into information? And how does information turn into knowledge and decisions? Do these polls truly reflect the reality of the ground in Armenia, or are they simply a continuation of what has become tradition in Armenia, where political polls almost always conspicuously favor the party in power? Okay, so the three polls. First one is from MPG LLC, and this is also called Gallup, because MPG is part of Gallup International Association. And this poll yielded headlines such as 88.1% of survey respondents positively assess Armenian PM's activity. The poll particularly resulted in a heated discussion in our own Facebook group with Samvel Farmanyan, a former Republican member of parliament and co-founder of Karyak Media, joining in the discussion. One of the arguments brought up in the discussion was that this is the same MPG group that found that Serzh Sarkisian and Karan Karapetyan had no other competition for the position of prime minister as late as April 2018. This is the same MPG group that in 2013, during the elections of 2013, claimed that Serzh Sarkisian had 69% popularity while Rafi Hovhannissian had only 11% popularity. So, you know, is it not valid to question the reliability of any of these polls that come out of MPG? So the second poll that I want to talk about, and I'll just go over three of them and we can go dive into more details, is the Caucasus Barometer, and it's from a group called Caucasus Research Resource Center, CRCC, and they publish public opinion data sets across the three Caucasian countries. In Armenia, they conduct the polls of individuals sampled from public voter lists published by the CEC. The polling was done in person with more than 60 questions covering a range of topics. While the results were published recently, the poll was actually conducted in February and March. So this is pre-COVID. And here are some interesting results from that one. So around 24% of Armenians want to leave the country forever. You might think that's bad news, but if you look at 2017, that number was 35%. However, the best value for this was in 2008, when only 20% of Armenians wished to leave Armenia. I want to say that that's good news, but it's still sort of depressing. On to a few more political questions. 80% say everything will be fine in 2020. Compare that with 47% in 2017. 71% approve of the executive government. In 2017, that was 20%. So these two questions are hugely in favor of the current government. And the third question was, which party is closest to you? Where only 35% said Civic Contract, which is Pashinyan's party, and 42% said no such party. That's a discrepancy we can deliberate. The last poll was from EU Neighbors East, and this one, again, you know, measures something called level of trust in institutions. And again, the trust in government was 76%. Trust in parliament was 59%. And they're both huge margins of improvement over 2018. The other poll by the EU, the other question that from the EU poll that I found interesting was, what do you consider to be the most pressing problems facing your country? And only 35% said unemployment, which is down 50% from 2019, which is down from 50% in 2019. Even though there is no, I don't think there's any economic statistic that says actually unemployment improved. The other measure, which is standard of living, in 2020, 26% concerned about low living standards, and in 2019 this was 34%. So again, people are less concerned about poverty, without, you know, me seeing any justification that actually poverty has improved in Armenia over the last 2 years. I may be wrong. So okay, let's begin with the MPG Gallup poll. Does this poll pass your smell test? Asped K.
Thanks, Sodik. I'd rather not discuss the analysis of the polls in detail because it can end up being quite politicized and can be drawn different ways. I think regardless of what polls do or the methodology of the polls, one thing that one needs to keep in mind is the Bradley effect. I think in 1982, when Tom Bradley, who was the mayor of Los Angeles, he was running for governor, you know, polls show that he was actually ahead in the polls, but then it turned out that he wasn't. And I think there is a way that you ask the question. There's also a way that people respond, sometimes because of pressure, social pressure, peer pressure, and so on. People would not express their true intentions about how to vote and so on and so forth. But from that put aside, I think it's quite problematic to deal with to base judgments, political decisions based on these polls. So the methodology might be sound, but the issue of sample, the issue of the way the questions are asked and so on are major issues to look at. So from that perspective, we have to always consider those rather than just what are the questions and take the answers and develop a whole strategy or a political agenda around it or a political analysis around it. Now, that being said, you know, there are some things that are common. For instance, people being more hopeful, people trusting more government, the government more, and so on and so forth, regardless if they are pro-government or not. But the fact that in 2018, after the Velvet Revolution, I think there is a sense of optimism, even if you do not agree. There's more level of more openness by people. So that is one. But the other thing is that politics in Armenia is like a pendulum. Whoever's in power today will end up being the most popular. So I think, again, the polls, obviously, they show what people think right now, but there's also the time delay, right? Government, how is the government performing? You know, when the question was asked in February, March versus now, it would be interesting to see the follow-up for that after, you know, COVID-19, after the pandemic. So I think there's a lot of room for development or a lot of room for improvement. But more often than not, I think polls can be misguiding and misleading political analysis and can provide either overconfidence to one side or basically, you know, demoralize another side.
Yeah, and Samuel Farmanian argued in that Facebook thread that these telephone polls suffer greatly from non-response bias, which is, I don't think you mentioned, and criticized MPG for not releasing data about the survey responses. Are there any thoughts in terms of how participation bias in general can be manipulated or play, you know, can be played upon to, you know, achieve desired results? Emil, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Asbet that sampling is a very, very important thing in polling. We've seen this even in the United States. You know, some very important polls before very important elections did not or failed predict outcome. And I think Armenia definitely suffers from sort of tradition of reliable polling. At the same time, I would say it's better to have some polling than not to have any polling. And one thing that I have seen is that at least if you have a polling service that does polling regularly with some regularity, I don't know, every couple of months or in the peacetime or pre-election time, every couple of weeks, you have, you know, some indication of where trends are going, because you could see trends are typically much more helpful predictor of what is happening than the, you know, the moment in time sort of capture. And we've seen that, for example, with the Armenian elections, how, you know, Nikol Pashinyan's position improved over the years versus other opposition figures. We've seen that, you know, in terms of how Karen Karapetyan's factor was very important. And I hope you remembered the 2018 polling. Yeah, Karen Karapetyan was a very popular figure up until April 2018. He had more Facebook followers than Nikol Pashinyan. And now Nikol Pashinyan is like the king of Armenian Facebook. So you have to look at the trends and you have to sort of work with establish this tradition of reliable polling that Armenia still doesn't have, and I'm not sure when they're going to have. As Asbet indicated, certainly there's been a positive shift in Armenian public attitudes overall, and it's natural because what happened in 2018 was the in a large part an exercise of public will and popular will, and you know, people feeling that power to replace a government, I think, is a very, very significant boost of self-confidence for the public. And it's obviously still reflected in the polls and probably continue to be reflected. As far as what is happening in Armenia right now in the last few months, I mean, we obviously have a big challenge with the pandemic, and the government of Armenia just... just like any other government around the world, is under big pressure to at least come across as doing everything they can to help you know deal with this problem.
Okay, Alan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to. I agree with what the other speakers have said. Yeah, I just wanted to add to that a little bit. Asbet mentioned the Bradley effect, and recently I heard a debate where Hrant Mikhailian mentioned this thing called the shy Tory effect. Basically, in the UK, during elections, the conservatives appear to do a lot better than they do in polling, because people are shy about revealing that they're conservatives. Apparently, this was a major factor in the 2015 election. And I thought, just in general, you know, these different effects in different sort of environments, basically saying the same thing, that that polling can sometimes be flawed. Not to say that that's necessarily the case in Armenia. It's very possible that this is an actual reflection of popular opinion, at least, you know, 4 or 5 months ago. But just something to definitely think about. And yeah, I think I definitely agree with Emil. The tides turned very quickly in Armenia. Yeah, in 2018, Karen Karapetyan was very popular. In the 2017 parliamentary election, the Republicans won almost 50% of the vote. And then a month later, Taron Markaryan and the Republicans won 70+% in the Yerevan municipal elections. And, you know, 18 months later, the Republicans had lost both of those. You know, and my step won 82% in the Yerevan election. I feel like in general, any political party in Armenia has relatively small percentage of loyal followers. I don't know what that percentage is, maybe 5%, maybe a little bit more than that. But whoever wins gets a huge bonus. And, you know, everyone wants to be on the side of the incumbent and on the side of the ruling party. And right now we're not in a state of equilibrium, but at some point I feel like we will get to the point where there will be a little bit more parity across the political parties. And also just to touch on what Hovik said about the non-response bias and also what Emil said, really the non-response bias is interesting only in the context of comparisons. If the non-response bias is 40% now and it was higher in the past, then that's a cause for concern. And I think it's worth at least discussing what may be the cause of that. But if it hasn't changed, and I haven't looked at the numbers, then that's a different question.
Yeah, they did not publish the participation rate for the MPG one, but actually the caucuses barometer one. The response rate to the 2019 or 2020 was 37.14%. Meanwhile, back in 2013, that same survey got a response rate of 65%, so almost twice as much, or nearly twice as much. I couldn't find information about 2015 or 2017, but I think anyone who is dealing with the caucuses barometer one should probably look into why there was a huge difference. But the other question I want to actually ask, which is, do you think that any of the populist activities that took place at the time of polling, so for instance, for the caucuses barometer in February, March, there was the constitutional referendum campaign going on and the constant sort of attacks against the constitutional court. Do you think that any of those actions by the government could have an effect, temporary effect on the polls? And Elspeth, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, absolutely, Hovik. You're right. I mean, again, when you're asked a question at the moment, the person, the respondent, will be influenced by their perception of what's happening at the moment. So if they feel that they have a good job, if they feel that they're like things are going okay, or if they approve of the government, government activities, they will end up, giving high marks to the government and other institutions. If there's, let's say there's a scandal in the military at the time of the poll, then people's perception and approval of the military institutions or the security institutions would be less. So absolutely, I think this is one of the constant problems. And that's why politicians, political parties and politicians in the West, most more so than in Armenia, they try to maintain that plateau of constantly, appeasing the public to be able to get good grades, good marks. And obviously that intensifies when you get closer to elections or major polling timetables. So definitely, I think that's the case. And that's why, it's like astrophysics, right? We don't see the light that is coming now from the sun. It's like 7 minutes ago. The light that we see now from the sun is 7 or 8 minutes ago, and so on. So the polls that we're seeing now is a reflection of what was happening, what was the mood like in Armenia in February, March.
Yeah. And as we close this topic, what conclusions can we draw from the three polls? I think we talked a little bit about it. But also one question that I asked Farmanyan, which he didn't respond to, he adamantly claimed that Pashinyan's popularity rating was actually in the 10% range. And he said that the telephone polls by MPG were being manipulated. But is there something that the government can do to help strengthen the Institute of Polling itself so that it's more reliable? Elspeth is shaking his head.
Yes. I think when the whole point of a polling and reliable polling is its independence, right? So from that perspective, in the United States, you have polling agencies that are politicized as well. So and that is manifested in the form that they ask the question. We had this discussion before privately while conducting research. For instance, if I were to ask, many years ago, there was a poll about Turkish-Armenian border opening, and people would respond. And the question, the way the question was framed, already biases. because the people who were conducting the poll were basically against the border opening. And the question was framed in a way that, do you want the border with Turkey and Armenia to be open for economic, political, and whatever reason, even if Turkey continues its genocidal policies against Armenians and against the rest of the world and so on? So now you already have a bias from the in the form of a question. That we're going to see. And I think a good point in terms of analyzing polls, A, is the reliability and the methodology of the poll, but also compiling polls. You know which who is behind the poll, not in terms of, looking for conspiracy theories, but knowing, okay, there's a political bias in this pollster for the government. There is a pollster which is pro-state, pro-opposition, and there is a pollster which is more or less biased, unbiased, and so on. So it's a lot of work. And, to paraphrase the term, lies, damn lies, and statistics, it's lies, damn lies, and polls. So at the end of the day, we have to keep all of those biases in mind while making assumptions or while making political calculations. But in terms of government regulating the field, I mean, it's sort of like saying the government should regulate the social media field in Armenia. It's like herding cats.
Okay, well, thank you for that aspect. All right, let's go on to our next topic, which is COVID. So Armenia's COVID-19 response continues to worry us by leading the charts in metrics such as cases per 1 million population and the infection rate among those tested, which hovers around 25 to 30%. And ideally, this number should be below 5%. The opposition is questioning the government's response effort and wants to launch an investigation in the National Assembly. And the parliament majority, MyStep, has refused to spend time and resources on such an investigation. Meanwhile, the Pashinyan administration is doubling down on its strategy of containing COVID, apparently through masks, by increasing fines and upping enforcement efforts on the ground. There have been videos circulated on Facebook of police brutality against people not wearing masks. Now, there will be test times in the parliament over the coming weeks as the government plans to introduce legislation that could potentially allow them to commandeer resources at private hospitals in the fight against COVID. This was something I just remember seeing on Azatürk'ün radio today. So with that background, I wanted to quickly take a look at some of the stats. Okay, so this week, Armenia on the average did about 1,700 tests per day, and the test positivity rate barely moved from 30% to 27%. And to me, this is the biggest cause of worry because, if your test positivity is so high, you should rapidly increase the number of tests. And I'm not seeing that. The some of the other, the deaths are back to like more than 100 for this week. And as of last week, Armenia is, when you exclude all the countries that are less than 1 million in population, Armenia is number 5 in the world in terms of cases per 1 million. And number 18 in terms of deaths. So it is worrying. I wanted to see if you have any thoughts on this so far. And, what is exactly sort of Armenia doing wrong, if anything, to see metrics like this? Aspet, if you can.
I think, the policies have been sort of flip-flopping. That's the thing. No clear policy, sort of what's happening in some states in the United States where they open too early and then you see a resurgence of the epidemic, of the pandemic and so on and so forth. And I think, A, it was the government, that they established the policies, but they didn't follow up. The major problem was the follow-up. And probably there is an element of keeping a balance between economic, understanding that the economic consequences, and they didn't want to do, they didn't want to damage the economy because that would hurt the popularity. So, and then they returned, they turned back, and then they introduced more harsher sort of rules to enforce, wearing masks and social distancing and so on. But I think the damage was already done. I think it's twofold. And yes, there is also, because of the lack of government sense of urgency, people are also not taking it seriously. We've seen this in Brazil, for instance, where Jair Bolsonaro, downplayed the virus and people were not wearing. And then we see that he caught the virus now and in the United States and other places as well. So I think at the end of the day, leading by example, that was one of the biggest challenges of the government. They didn't start leading by example from the get-go. Rather, it was a sort of an afterthought where the damage was already done. I think the resources are adequate to handle this, especially with aid coming in and assistance coming in from countries like Georgia, from France, from even the diaspora has mobilized to through various organizations to assist. It's just a matter of sticking to the plan and following the line, which the government has I believe has failed miserably.
Yeah. So the parliamentary inquiry actually is the fight over that is interesting because the opposition is accusing the government of mishandling the COVID-19 crisis. And they had a motion to set up the inquiry, which passed the assembly because it got the required 37 votes. But just like before, when there was another incident, I think it was referred to as Kamazgate, the majority can still essentially sort of thwart this by refusing to endorse the actual composition of the committee. There have been very emotional arguments on the Facebook group itself that say that this is a waste of time and resources, and we're in a war, and we should focus on fighting COVID, and we'll figure this out later. But I wanted to ask our participants what you thought of this move, and what outcome can we expect from such a commission, assuming it is allowed to be set up in the first place? And since Ospet just answered, let me ask Alan, what are your thoughts on this inquiry?
I think, as far as I know, there is a precedent. I think in other countries, there are also inquiries that have been launched to look into potential mishandling of the crisis. There's an argument to be made that it might not be the best way to spend our time now. Maybe it's better to handle this after everything is done and we have the advantage of hindsight. Because I am also critical of the way that this government has handled the crisis, but there is to be fair, the crisis is not over yet, and there is still time to potentially correct some of the mistakes that were made earlier in the handling of the crisis. But yeah, I agree with Ospet that the flip-flopping and a lot of the decisions that were made early on made it much harder for Armenia to come out of this with minimal losses. The main issue, I think, was at the onset, if there was a very orchestrated and planned approach, then we could have minimized the exposure to the virus early on, and that would have allowed a more surgical approach to containing the virus. And the surgical approach would then obviously mean that there was minimal disruption to the economy, which is also something that Ospet mentioned. What they decided to do at some point is after the initial full lockdown, they realized that the economy is not going to do well in this situation. So then they went to the other extreme and pretty much fully opened everything up. And then in the next phase, they decided that that's not going to work. So they're going very hard with the enforcing the wearing of masks. At the onset, if the borders were closed at the right time, people were quarantined appropriately early on. It's very possible that this would not have gotten out of hand, and it could have been, the economy, a full lockdown may not have even been necessary even very early on. So, but again, to be fair, this thing is not over yet. There's probably another 6 to 12 months left. So let's hope that things go better moving forward.
Okay. So one thing I'm fascinated by, well, not fascinated. I mean, I'm a huge proponent of masks, but the government's policy around wearing masks and heavily optimizing for that is what is perplexing me. So Armenia continues to press its citizens to wear masks in an effort to increase compliance. Earlier in the week, the majority faction, IMKAIL, in National Assembly introduced and then promptly withdrew a bill that would increase fines. In addition to increasing general compliance, the government has changed its guidance recently and actually asks people to not wear cloth masks and instead wear surgical masks if they can afford them. This seems to be a slight distinction from any other government, this is, you know, the United States that I've seen. And at a government meeting on July 2, Nicole Pashinyan actually seemed to suggest that, you know, he's going to call all citizens to only to use factory-produced masks. You know, I just can't help but think about the financial implications of this move, as, you know, a single mask costs a couple hundred dram, I think, you know, less, more than, like, around 50% of the population lives on around $5 a day. Armenia has one of the strictest mask-wearing requirements around the world. They went so far as to require news anchors to wear masks on TV, in TV studios. In fact, two opposition TV channels were visited by police and fined for not wearing masks. There is a nice rebuttal that we'll link in the show notes Arm News, the anchor from Arm News, talking about this. But the management of those channels claims that they were maintaining social distancing and they were compliant with previous guidelines from the TV and Radio Commission, allowing broadcasters to work without masks. Yet they got fined anyway. Emil, what is your thought on this specific aspect? Is there, you know, is there anything else they can focus on, or is, you know, optimizing, you know, the mask usage to 100% the only thing that they should do?
Well, look, I mean, we have to be objective and look at how unprepared the most sophisticated healthcare professionals have been for this pandemic. I mean, you look at Anthony Fauci in the United States, that sort of looked up to as the authority on this issue. Literally, what, 2-3 weeks before the lockdown in the United States, he claimed that the threat from COVID was minuscule to Americans. And, you know, it went from minuscule to overencompensating and the worst crisis ever within weeks. So to expect that the Armenian government would have been in any way better prepared for this, considering how unprepared it is for everything else, it has to deal with totally, out of place. If we look at how other countries have dealt with this issue, we already kind of touched on some of the successful cases of suppression, including Georgia. Of course, we have a bunch of island nations, mostly in Asia, be that, Taiwan or Singapore, or Australia and New Zealand were able to isolate and sort of suppress. They, you know, obviously have considerably better medical systems than Armenia does. Armenia wasn't able to do that for, you know, reasons that we can already mentioned, some bad management and also bad luck. But now that it has sort of, it's in Armenia and the suppression has failed, all we can do, and all we can expect the Armenian government to do is to mitigate the problem and sort of make sure that they have enough healthcare capacity to address this. And so far, it seems like there's been enough healthcare capacity. I think from the data that I've seen in the last few weeks, Armenia has reached its peak of the infections. We will not know until we will know, but it appears that they have. And if we look at all the other cases around the world, this is basically the only way out is for the epidemic to finish, and it will finish when it will finish. In the meantime, if I can switch gears, I don't know if you're following the situation on the Armenian-Azerbaijani border. It seems like the problem of COVID is considerably a problem for Azerbaijani government as well, and right now they still haven't reached their peak. just judging by their population and whatnot and the trends. And it seems that in the last few weeks they have been openly threatening to sort of resume military political pressure on the border with Armenia, and they appear to have had done it. And just a few hours ago there was a major clash on the border. I think this coming week we will have a new distraction. from
yeah,
COVID.
We saw the reports of two dead and three wounded from the Azeri side, and apparently
That is going to be sort of distracting Armenia's and Azerbaijan's attention, I think, for the coming probably days and weeks. Returning to the COVID issue, you just have to be patient. And I think the problem from the beginning was, the big problem was the panic, because initially there was underestimation of the threat, and then there was the overestimation of the threat, and immediate lockdowns in most places, and without consideration that lockdowns can only last a certain period of time, maybe a couple of months at most, without damaging people in various ways. So in Armenia's case, obviously the lockdown was introduced too early, way before there was any major spread in Armenia. When it was lifted, it was of course lifted too early as well, but it just, they had to lift it. And now returning to the lockdown, it's unclear how helpful it's going to be to sort of mitigate the situation. I think, like I said, the peak has been reached. Of course, we've seen in other cases the decline is slow. But I think Armenia will be out of this pandemic before the end of summer, and hopefully it won't be any major reoccurrences.
Aspet Kochikyan, I just wanted to ask you, is it ridiculous to require TV hosts to wear masks in a TV studio? And is there a precedent for this that you're aware of? And lastly, are there... do you think that these efforts are motivated by health concerns or public relations considerations or something else?
Oh, both. I think there might be political and health concerns. But it's a matter, the law is also a matter of interpretation, right? If I were to say, if the law says that in any enclosed space when there are more than 3-4 people, everyone has to wear a mask, a TV studio where you have the camera people, you have the reporters, you have the producer and so on, they have to wear a mask. I understand the challenges of broadcasting and speaking and reading the news with a mask on, but there are always ways to get around it. TV stations can isolate the speaker in a separate room, who she or he can remove the mask and speak. But this raises a bigger question that under the guise of COVID-19, governments have been able to crack down on opposition and so on. I don't think that Armenia is there yet in terms of the level that you would see in other places like in Hungary or in China, for instance, but it can easily be used in that context.
Thanks, and that's a nice segue into our next topic, which we would like to have as a permanent agenda, which is the state of Armenian media. And this past week, there was actually a nice report from the Public Journalism Club, PJC, which is an OSF-funded NGO in Armenia, and they released a white paper which, among other things, concludes that the media activity during the state of emergency and the restrictions imposed on media, that's the title. Now, some important sort of points here. During the initial lockdown, Armenia introduced restrictions on dissemination of news related to COVID, requiring news only to be from official sources. My own understanding of this is this is very rare in the world, and I haven't seen any other country implement something like this. Maybe there are. I'd like to know your thoughts. So Aspet, are you? What is your reaction to that aspect? And I know that they removed the restrictions eventually, but do you see still some kind of pressure on the media, and How do you think the media should react to this, to these kinds of requirements from the government?
Well, Emil mentioned earlier about the sense of panic that the government was trying to bypass in terms of what related to COVID-19. And unfortunately, one of the major issues in Armenia with related to journalism is the sensationalism and blowing things out of proportion. Now, it's interesting that it wasn't a crackdown on the media, as and as you mentioned, Hovik, it was a crackdown. It was basically restrictions on reporting about COVID-19. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Probably the intention there was to make sure that false information will not be disseminated. But I think it's the major challenge. I personally am, myself am torn between the idea of should the media be free to report anything, even if it's completely bogus and completely hysterical and factually doesn't have any basis. Or you should let people say whatever they want, knowing full well that citizens would be, you know, are more likely to believe sensationalist news than regular news or more factual-based news. So, and there are cases, but that those are not the golden golden sort of standards, like China, for instance, in terms of focusing on or cracking down on the media. So I think that is a major challenge in terms of how much you can allow false information of the about COVID-19 spread or the usage of masks versus non-masks or COVID-19 is a hoax and so on to be disseminated in the public sphere. I'm personally am not sure. Again, their heart might have been in the right place, but of course it can easily be misdirected and be used in a general way to marginalize you know, vocal critics of the government.
Asped Bedrosian, actually I wanted to ask you, do you have any thoughts on this issue? Alan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a very tough question to answer. Obviously, like Asped said, you don't want people disseminating information that could be harmful to the public. I think part of the problem early on was that reputable voices were being somewhat silenced. I remember there was a doctor that posted something on Facebook. I think it was something along the lines of the minibuses should be, you know, not operating, you know, because they get packed very tight, and that could be a major source of spread. And I, if I'm not mistaken, I remember police officers, I think, showed up at his house and asked him to remove the post, which, you know, and this was a reputable doctor. So I think there's definitely a distinction to be made between, you know, people spreading panic and spreading misinformation and actual voices that should be heard being silenced.
Yeah, I can't help but think, you know, on Grung, we always post news from the other side, Azeri news. And I think that in general, my thought about journalism is that the only way to clear out false news is by allowing the true news to be presented. But Asped, what are your thoughts?
Hovik, my greatest concern, I think, is about the erosion of trust in the Armenian media. When this is the way that fake media basically rises to erode your ability to understand which news is meaningful, which news is actually actual, factual, truthful, and you don't know exactly where to turn. At some point, you don't know exactly who to trust to understand a situation that is relevant and surrounding you.
Yeah.
And like you have said, on Grung, at least, we have tried to present all sides of a topic from various sources. And some of them we know are not entirely factual, and we try to put a comment about that as well. The important thing is to give a 360 view of any subject as much as we can so that people have all the information that they need in order to make up their minds. But ultimately, that depends on the trust and the reliability of the media.
I wanted to cover one more issue related to COVID, and we're running out of time, but there was also this news report about a website called MedMedia, funded by USAID, that was purportedly spreading disinformation about COVID-19. I haven't looked at all of their material, but I know that some of their material was related to masks, and there was, I believe there were claims that, you know, masks, you know, wearing masks in certain cases and incorrectly may actually increase danger. I don't know the exact details. So I believe there was a major Western newspaper covered this. Public health officials sort of got on board, and the U.S. Embassy contacted the website and in order to take down the information. And the website refused. And as a result, the U.S. Embassy removed their funding. What are your thoughts, Asped, about this in terms of media freedom? And do you think this was a fair result?
I think it's a, and it goes back to what we were mentioning earlier, freedom of speech, yes, but at the same time, you know, when you do have a pandemic at that level going on in Armenia, any kind of a misinformation would have a problem. And the fact that the USAID defunded, they defunded the website, it tells you something about also overall government approaches to them. Listen, you know, people have a deep mistrust, inherent mistrust towards government, wherever you are. You know, a big bureaucracy, they don't know what they're doing, or we don't trust them, and so on and so forth. But good or bad, governments are the ones that are equipped to have a global public health policy. Good or bad, doesn't matter, but they're the only ones who can do that. And any attempt to undermine that is a public risk. It's not about politics. It can be politicized, but it's not just about politics. And I think, you know, the whole thing is that the idea of freedom of expression and giving you the same right to speak as I am is that you might end up using, you know, ignorant and whatever information. So your right, my right to inform you is the same as your right to misinform me. Which is, I think, it's really, I think, problematic. So from that perspective, I think the message was clear. Even if they didn't close it down, they can get their funding from other places. But at least the message sent by the government, the U.S. government, the U.S. embassy to defund it, I think, for people who are aware and are following, might be a signal that, okay, they're lying. Of course, some people would say, ah, see, they're speaking truth to power. That's why they were defunded. So no matter what you do, if you're conspiracy buff, you're going to look at it as an attempt to silence, you know, truth seekers.
So I just remembered the conversation I had on Twitter with another user, and they were mentioning that Armenia, there's a lot of mask denial in Armenia. But I just want to point out that there is a significant number of experts or people, you know, who are considered doctors and experts in the U.S. and in the West who also harbor such views, and they are not being silenced and they're not being muted. So where do you draw the line? And Emil, since I think we're running out of time, I want to turn it over to you. What are your thoughts about the state of media during this COVID pandemic and anything else that we discussed recently?
State of media during the pandemic, I mean, it's a challenging situation. It's an issue that's, you know, that is unprecedented for most people working in the Armenian media. There is no, you know, living history of previous pandemics in Armenia where you could, you know, sort of rely back on, sort of, you know, use that information. I've seen, you know, people, serious people make, you know, wrong assessments, and not just in Armenia. I already mentioned the Fauci example in U.S. So it's a challenging environment. I think the masks issue you were talking about, I mean, there is a sense that the masks or, you know, hand washing and all that are like cop-outs by the government to sort of do something obviously visible that, you know, that they can kind of enforce and, you know, sort of cover up the failure of either contact tracing or isolation or medical response, etc. So, you know, as long as this pandemic is progressing, there's going to be a lot of different emotional responses to it, and I expect the government to do its public relations and damage control. One thing that I have to say is that just imagine this whole situation happening with Serge Sargsyan still in power, and Nikol Pashinyan being the leader of the opposition. The mess in Armenia would have been a lot worse, I would say, considering how, Nikol Pashinyan would still be running around the hospitals and exposing the government. But, the level of panic and the level of disarray would probably be much, much higher. I'm happy that this is happening while the government in power enjoys a considerable level of support, maybe for reasons that are not particularly logical or rational, but it's just the reality. And what will eventually happen, I can't rule out the possibility that maybe in 5 to 10 years, when Nikol Pashinyan is out of power and he's replaced by somebody who is not particularly sympathetic towards him, there's going to be a commission and there's going to be a court case against Nikol Pashinyan and blaming Nikol Pashinyan for all the deaths in Armenia. I don't know. I mean, it's possible that this will play out, but like I said, it will be a derivative of political biases and political circumstances rather than objective criteria.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Any other closing comments from our guests? All right. Well, so this concludes our first podcast. I want to thank you again for participating here with us, and let's see what our listeners think about it.
And that concludes our show. Please write to us. You can do it on our Facebook page, ANN Groong, Groong, or our Facebook group, Armenian News Network Groong, or from our website at groong.org. Thank you, and we look forward to hearing from you. We'll be right back.